things that have been happening during the week. We're really glad you're here. During the course of the week, we ran a very, very big event called Summerfest. It was lots of fun. It culminated last night in a carnival out here, and there were heaps of people. Made me wish I was still 10 instead of 20, as I actually am. Actually, can I get the team who've been, the full-time team who've been part of Summerfest this week, can I get you guys to stand up now, just wherever you are? And can we give them a big round of applause? And before you sit down, can I get all the people who've helped during the course of the week, who've been part of the home base and the full-time team, can you guys stand up as well? There's a bunch of them all over the place, and some of them are shy. Why don't you give them a round of applause? And sit down. And these guys have been awesome servants during the course of the week, and it's been a fantastic event, a great opportunity to welcome many in our community, which is actually what we want to do as a church. We want to be open to the community that are around us and inviting. And last night was an example of that. I had such a good time. Now, if you're here this morning because you've heard about our summer series, this is the very first of those in the summer series, God and Evolution. You may have a card in your EV News. And can I invite you to take that EV News out, that bulletin you got as you came in, because you'll have a copy of the Bible reading we're looking at this morning. I'm going to try to pick up that topic, God and Evolution. And it's an enormously contentious one. We're doing it, by the way, because that's one of the major topics that our community said they wanted to hear about. And therefore, we've picked up those top four topics. We're going to consider them over the next few weeks. If you're here because of that, we're really glad you're here. If you hate evolution, you hate kind of technical stuff like this, it makes you feel like you're back at school, you can just have a little quiet doze this morning and we won't draw any attention to you at all. I'm going to pray. I'm going to pray as we come to this very contentious issue, and you might pray for me that I'm able to do it succinctly and carefully. I'm going to stop partway through toward the end, and I want to open up for questions. We want to have lots of time for you to ask those, and ask anything. I don't mind. Okay, I'm going to pray for us. Our Heavenly Father, we want to thank you because all truth is your truth. We don't want to be scared of it. We want to pursue it. We want to unravel as far as we're able. I want to pray this morning for us, if we're unfamiliar with these things, we've not looked at them before, help me to have clarity in the way I do that. I pray that you'll help me to keep it non-technical so people can understand well. But help us to be drawn to the main things, the things that are the conclusions of this rather important topic. What are we to think about you? What do we think about the Lord Jesus? I pray those things will be clear this morning, and I ask you to help me do that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, friends, I'm not sure if you're aware, but if you Google that topic, God and Evolution, you'll get 38 million web pages designed to tell you about this issue, and most of them are pretty fired up. Most of them on both sides of the event are very feisty. There's lots of heat in the debate. It's like the guy I met at the barbecue, I told some of you during the course of the week. The conversation turned to religious matters. What do you do for work was the question, and I answered that question. And I said that I'm responsible for teaching the Bible about Jesus, what it means to follow him. Have you got thoughts about him, I asked. And my friend said, well, I'm a logical, scientific person, so no, I don't think about that stuff very much. Now, I'm not a genius, but if you join the dots in what was just said then, you will conclude either that he thought I was very naive and very unintelligent, or he thought that the issue of God is very illogical, very unscientific. Did you pick that up in the comment there? I know you were astute enough to see that. But the implication was very clear, and it's not simply my friend who thought that. The chemistry professor at Oxford University, a fellow named Professor Peter Atkins, and he puts that issue like this, if I can make that slide come up there. Science and religion can't be reconciled. Religion has failed, and its failure should stand exposed. And perhaps you're here this morning and that's been your opinion, actually, that religion, in particular Christianity's got nothing logical or scientific to commend it. In fact, science has disproved it. Well, these are very common view on one side of the fence, actually. But the difficulty is you go to the other side and you find eminent scientists who say exactly the opposite thing. This is Francis Collins, who's been the head of the Human Genome Project. You know what I mean by that? They've been trying to unravel over the last 20 years or so, what's our DNA look like? And they've tried to map it. Here's what he says. I actually don't believe there are any collisions between what I believe as a Christian and what I know and have learned as a scientist. Two radically different, diametrically opposed views. Now, how can that possibly be? How can you have two views that are so different from two eminent scientists? And I'm sure that Peter Atkins is that. Now, I'm going to suggest a reason this morning. It's a very complex debate, but I'm going to try to keep it as simple as I can in the time we've got. But the reason I think at one level is very simple. It's because of assumptions that we all make about the Bible and what it says, and assumptions that we make about science and what it says and what it knows. And I'm suggesting this morning that we need to be very clear on both of those things. So I'm going to come to that in a second. But before I do, I've got an even more fundamental question to actually ask. And perhaps you're thinking at this very question there as you sit at the moment, kind of pondering this enormous issue. The question is this: why does it matter? Why should I even care? Now, has that question come to your mind? You've not thought much about evolution since school. You're really glad you haven't had to do that. It was kind of biology and it was years ago in the dark ages and you're so glad you're past it. Why does the issue actually matter? I want to help you think why it matters for just a moment. Come back 150 years in time. 150 years in time and to the time before Charles Darwin published his famous theory, which is briefly called, it had a very long title, On the Origin of Species, what it was called. That was 1859, a little over 150 years ago, and it was a very different world. It was the established view of society then was, generally speaking, the Judeo-Christian view. It was the view that all life was intrinsically valuable, and especially human life, it was tremendously valuable, irrespective of race or age, irrespective of gender. It had purpose, it had meaning. There was a objective basis for right and wrong, for recognising that some things in our society are evil. And the world itself, the natural world around us, was worthy of study because it was the creation of a good God, was the assumption of the day. So science actually grew out of that assumption about God, out of that worldview. And given that it was God's gift, the world was ours not simply to nurture, but also to protect. And we didn't always do that particularly well, but that was the conviction of most people at the time. Now, what's happened in the years since then? Well, in the years since then, that view has been replaced very dramatically, most particularly over the last 50 or so years, by a different worldview. You know what I mean by worldview? A view of the way the world fits together and the way it operates. It's called a naturalistic worldview. It's not a scientific view necessarily. It's a philosophy. It's a philosophy of life. And the philosophy is fundamentally this, that we're committed to finding our answers in natural means. We don't want to invoke some sort of power from outside. We want to find the answers in science and only in natural science. And therefore the world it envisages, that particular worldview, is very different in character. And let me see if I can express it for you in the words of a very quotable man, Richard Dawkins. How many of you have heard of Richard Dawkins? He'll come up a few times this morning, you'll see him on TV. And here's what he says. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. I love Richard Dawkins, don't you? I love the way he puts things so so starkly, so you know exactly where he's coming from. Now, I hope you can see that's a very different view of life, isn't it? There is no purpose. There's no good or bad. And in his second book, actually, Charles Darwin way back then in the 19th century. His second book was called The Descent of Man. And he drew out the implications of his theory in exactly the kind of direction that Richard Dawkins, 100 or so years later, has drawn out himself, for a whole bunch of reasons, actually. He's drawn out what are the implications of evolutionary theory for issues like racism, for issues like the place of women. His disciples, after Darwin, applied it to issues like abortion and euthanasia and genocide and even the legal system. Actually, I'm not sure if I put up the slide for this, but no, I haven't. So let me give you a quote from a criminology textbook written about, probably 70 years after Darwin. And it makes this point about how we work in the field of criminology. It says this: man's no more responsible for becoming willful and committing a crime than the flower is for becoming red and fragrant. Did you get that? Let me give it to you again. Still a little bit of a thinking time this morning. See if you can manage it for a little while. We won't keep you at it for too long. The man is no more responsible for becoming willful and committing a crime than the flower is for being red and smelling nice. Now, why is that? Why do you think they were saying that? Because both of them are just the products of evolution. Flowers go red and they smell nice because that's what their genes tell them to do. People commit crimes and do things that are wrong because that's what their genes tell them to do. It's an interesting little bypath that theory led us into, but there were some of the implications of that emerging theory as we tried to wrestle with what we thought we knew. Back in those days, 70 years ago. Friedrich Nietzsche, now some of you will have heard of that name, but many of you won't. He was an atheist. He died early last century, and he predicted that the result of removing God out of the world and just leaving evolutionary theory would mean that the 20th century would be the most bloody century in all of human history. In fact, he said, Darwin's teaching may be true, but it's deadly. It may be true, but it's deadly. And actually, the events of the 20th century proved him to be entirely correct. The gas chambers, the eugenics experiments of World War II, the sterilisation of people groups, like the hillbillies in America, but all sorts of people groups, actually, all throughout the world. The mass slayings carried out by communist regimes from Pol Pot to Joseph Stalin were actually a direct result of assumptions we'd made about what we thought we knew about the science of evolution. We made all sorts of wrong mistakes. Now remember, none of this is to say that the theory of evolution is wrong. In fact, I'm not saying that this morning. I think some of it is not well-founded. I think some of it's not correct. But I'm not saying it's not wrong. None of that says it's wrong. And none of this says that the God view of life is right either. But simply saying this, if you want to live by the truth, and I take it that's what you want to do, don't you? You don't want to live a lie. You don't want to live a fantasy existence. If you want to live by the truth, you need to be courageous enough to know the truth, know where it leads, even if you don't like it. And there's some of the implications of evolutionary theory, at least as far as we followed it. And of course, after World War II, we recognised some of the terrible things about that. We rethought it. But we haven't rethought it scientifically, not necessarily. Now, there's why the issue matters. Well, there's part of why it matters, actually. But there's an even greater reason than that. It matters because of this. If Jesus Christ is telling the truth about life, then there is actually a true and living God. That is, there's an intelligence behind our world who designed it, who cares for it, who's made you for it and you for him, and to whom we'll actually give an account. If Jesus is right. There you've got two things. You've got Jesus on the one hand. You've got much of our modern theory of, but not all, of our modern theory of evolution on the other. There's why it matters. Big things are at stake in it. So I want to invite you this morning to consider that first question I raised a little while ago. What does the Bible say about God and evolution, and what doesn't it say so we can be clear on that one. And then we'll move on to the second question. What does science say? What do we know and what do we not know? Well, the place to start is in that little sheet that you got in your EV News. You want to pull it out? I'm not going to go through that exhaustively, but I want to give you a bit of a feel for it. It begins there in Genesis chapter 1 with its very famous introduction. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And though we rarely think about it, that little account you've got in front of you, which is so tremendously old, is not the only creation account that existed in ancient times. There were actually lots of creation accounts that existed, the Babylonian people, the Sumerian people, the Akkadian people, accounts like the Enuma Elish, which is an ancient creation account from Babylon, the Gilgamesh epic, which came from another ancient society, accounts which had all been written, just like this one, to make a point about the character of the gods that they worshipped. Every civilization has had a god, as far as we can tell. Anthropologists have not found one yet that doesn't. And in those creation accounts, unlike the Genesis one, they were celebrating many gods. Lots of gods, actually. And as they talked about how the creation came about, there was a common theme in most of them, that there was warfare between the gods. One would battle against another, and out of the entrails of the bodies that were left was created the sky and the land and the sea, and actually out of part of the bodily parts there came human beings who were to function, certainly in some of those accounts, as just slaves for the gods. There was our purpose. We weren't designed for anything. We were just accidental. There's the kind of world into which Genesis was written. Is that a surprise to you? We kind of think this is some sort of magic book that's dropped out of the sky. No. It's written in the context in history. It's written with all that stuff going on around it. Genesis is very different, radically different from those other creation accounts. It's different in this depiction of God. You picked that up, didn't you? Not many gods, but one God. One God who controls all things, like in sentence 16 there you might have noticed. He controls the sun, the moon and the stars. In sentence 21 there, the great creatures of the sea. Now, the significance of those, of course, is that in those other creation accounts that existed in Babylon, Samaria, etc., those were objects that were worshipped. They had special names, but in this account they're not given any special name at all, just generic things, because the point being made is they were not objects of worship. They were things under the clear control of the one creator God. It's a very different account. And secondly, the character of that God is very, very different. It's very different in the manner by which he creates. You might have noticed it as Ryan read it there. He's like a king. He simply commands, saying in verse 3 there, "Let there be." And in verse 4, "There was." And he surveys the results of his decree and he proclaims that it's good. That is, it fits his intention. It's exactly what he intended to make in the first instance. Not an accident, not a surprise. Oh my goodness, I didn't think that would happen. Like you get in those Far Side cartoons that we used to have. No, he's purposeful. He's not accidental. He's not haphazard. He's good. He's intentional. And the products of his creation are exactly what he intends. What's more, here's another little thing to note, is the rhythm. Did you notice that as Ryan read it? There's kind of like a rhythm that pulsates through that passage, like a drum beat. Very hard to miss. It's emphasised by the repetition of, well, my count is, there's seven elements each day there. Let me take you through them. And God said, "Let there be," and it was so, and God saw, and he called them, and there was evening and there was morning, and there was the first day, the second day, the third day, etc., etc., etc. There's a structure to it. It's not quite poetry, actually. It's not quite poetry, but it's on that spectrum between Sydney Morning Herald prose and, you know, poetry, some sort of stylized literature, designed to tell us something about this God and about his work. Not at all like the other creation accounts. What you're told about this God is he's powerful, he He's orderly, he's good, and he's moving with irresistible intent toward an inevitable goal. Now you see something of that on day six. Come down to day six there. I think it's around about sentence 24 and onwards, but I'm going to pick it up for you in sentence 26, where you get this unusual thing in sentence 26. Not unusual for those of you who are familiar with this account, but if you're not familiar with it, God does this unusual thing. He seems to confer within himself. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, so they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, etc." Do you notice that odd thing there? Let us. I mean, you ought to be struck by that strange plural thing that occurs with God in this account. Not the first time or the only time it occurs. Well, in fact, it's the first time, but not the only. But more to the point, did you notice the place of humanity in this? Remember how they were in the other creation accounts? They were like the slaves. But in this account, they're like the apex over the entire creation. They're almost godlike. They're not God, but they are like his vice deputies. And sentence 29 there and following, and of course into the next chapter, which we won't look at this morning, they're carefully provided for. Very different from those other contemporary accounts that existed at the time. But friends, I wonder if you've noticed this other oddity in it. It's an oddity that struck me when I first read this, and I was probably an 18-year-old kid. I'd never seen a Bible before. I had one. It was kind of in my underpants drawer. My uncle gave it to me years ago, and I'd never looked at it. I'd never opened it. I blew the dust off it, and things flew out of it. And when I read it, I was struck by this strange thing in day four. Come down to day four. I can't remember where day four actually is now, but you'll find it there. Because on day four, in sentence 14 it is, God creates the lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night. Now, when I read that, I was puzzled. Were you puzzled when you read that? What's the puzzling thing about that? What was that? I didn't hear it. That was the thing that puzzled me. Like, I'd read day one, there's light and there's dark, and my question was, how come the sun, the moon, etc. only appear on day four? What's happening with that? And it was very, very strange. Now, what's happening is the author was far more sophisticated than I had ever realised he was. I thought he was just some dumb pre-modern who wrote this account. He was much more sophisticated than I'd assumed. And in sentence two, come way back up to the beginning there, he actually gave you his clue to the logic of what he's doing in those days. He gave you this clue, sentence two. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Formless and empty. And so accordingly, in the days that follow, God creates the forms, actually, the structures of his creation. Day one, he created the light and the dark. Day two, he created the oceans and the skies. Day three, he created the land and the plants, actually. So what does he do on day four, given the clue that he gave you in verse two? Well, he fills it. He creates the form, then he fills it with the sun, the moon, and the stars. He fills the oceans and the sky with the fish and the birds. He fills the land with the animals and the man. Now, I hadn't noticed that. Had you noticed that before? Tremendously interesting piece of detail. See, I was trying to read it as a chronological account. I was trying to read it like I'd read the Sydney Morning Herald. Do you know, this guy committed a crime and this is what happened, and after that this is what happened then. But the structure of what he's doing suggests that's not his big point at all. He's not trying to give you a blow-by-blow description of how God created. He's giving you a thematic account. Not trying to show you the order of creation events. There's something much more important that he's seeking to do in that account. He's trying to tell you something about the character of this God. What do you think his structure tells you about the character of God? Well, just what I said to you already. He's orderly. He's powerful. It fits his intentions. He's in total control of everything. Now, got that under your belt? So what's that got to do with creation and evolution? Because that's why we're here this morning, I take it. What's that little observation got to do with creation and evolution? Well, there's a bunch of things actually that tells you. Firstly, it means this chapter is not teaching, most likely, how long it took God to create. He could have done it in six 24-hour days. He could have done that. But I would guess the clue here is that's not the author's intention to tell you that. He's not trying to tell you the order in which he did it. He's not trying to tell you when Adam and Eve lived. He's not even trying to tell you, kids, if you're still in here, when the dinosaurs arrived. Has every kid you've ever met asked you about that? Or perhaps the people sitting next to you have asked you about that. Not designed to tell you that. There is an answer in it. It's not telling you about how. It's telling you about who. It's telling you about the God who created. He's orderly and he's powerful. Here's the second thing it means. It's not really addressing your common questions about the issue of evolution. So if God wanted to use evolutionary processes to put in part some parts of his creation, what's to stop him from doing it? He uses gravitational processes, doesn't he? He uses magnetic processes. He uses geological processes. So what if he uses evolutionary processes? I think he probably does. In fact, I'm pretty certain he does for some parts of it. And I'll come back to that in a moment if you've got questions. In fact, when you come to Genesis chapter 2, chase it up at home. This is meant to be a shortish talk. There's a second creation account. It's like not like he got the first one wrong so he'd write a second one. No, it's one that kind of focuses in on human beings so that you can see them in fine detail. And what you find in that one is that the trees only grow when the rain comes. How do you think the trees arrived in chapter 1? Bang. You thought they were there at the end of day 3, didn't you? That's what it looks like. But when you come to chapter 2, you find that's not quite the case. Chapter 2 is giving you a whole different view. They've grown naturally. Which tells you this, naturalistic processes were involved. The author wasn't trying to rule that out in chapter 1. Just telling you something very much bigger. Was the author a naive fool? And he didn't realise what he'd written in chapter 1, and he wrote a whole different thing in chapter 2, and he thought afterwards, oh man, I've published it now. Everyone's going to get it wrong. No. He's got a particular intention in chapter 1. He's telling you something different in chapter 2. Now, some people are divided over the issue of creation and evolution because of assumptions they've made about the Bible and what it says. And some of us have made those assumptions because it's convenient. Kind of convenient to write that whole God thing off. But an intelligent look at the Bible puts that to bed. Others, though, are divided because of assumptions they've made about what we know from science. Now, how are you feeling? Tell me if you're tracking okay with me. Because we're about to enter into the realm of science, and you figure, man, I hate science. Track with me for a couple of minutes, see how you go. How much do you remember about this stuff from school, evolution? That much? Depends how long ago it was. Let me tell you about the theory of evolution. As a theory, I think it's absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's simple, it's elegant, it's logical, and given enough time, given a lot of time, given a very, very long period of time, it's entirely plausible. And it's got some very compelling evidence to support it. Let me take you through that really quickly. In 1859, Darwin's theory was just one of many theories about evolution. There were a whole bunch of competing theories at the time. But evidence to support it began to mount, to grow, like the variation of species. Charles Darwin, 1831, he was a young man. He journeyed to the Galapagos Islands. Know where they are? Off the coast of South America. He recorded lots of examples of finches and mockingbirds and other sorts of species, which were minutely varied in kind of significant ways from the species he saw on the mainland of South America. And they appeared to be related as common finch and mockingbird ancestors. And so he formulated his special theory of evolution. The special theory of evolution was that species gradually evolve over time. And he figured if a little bit of change is possible in a little bit of time, maybe in a lot of time, a lot of change is possible. That was his general theory of evolution, but he proposed his special theory, and it was supported by lots and lots of evidence. You know, people who had crossbred peas, people who had crossbred plants and flowers and donkeys and salmon and dogs and finches and all those kind of things, there was lots of supporting evidence for it. Now, most of us call that, what do you call that kind of evolution there that Darwin observed, first of all? Well, some of us call it adaptation. Remember that word? Remember that, Shay? How long ago was biology for you? No, don't say. It doesn't give away. But if you remember from school, you will have learned about adaptation. You will have learned about that kind of thing. Others call it microevolution. But there was support for it everywhere, and there still is. Then support came from geology. Because if Darwin's theory was true, then the layers of rock, you know, when you go to the Hawkesbury River and you see those cuttings on the expressway and you see those layers of rock and bedding planes there, those layers of rock, if Darwin's theory was true, should show some sort of developing tree. You should see more ancient forms of life at the bottom. You ought to see more recent forms of life closer to the top. And that's what scientists began to find. It was good supporting evidence. And that tree of life implied that we should find, if that whole tree of life that Darwin imagined, if it was true, we should find these what's called, I'll give you the term, then you can forget it, right? Transitional forms. Transitional forms. That is, they were fossils and fossil evidence that had gradually morphed over time as one species turned into another. So as you saw fish morph into reptiles and reptiles morph into birds and birds morph into mammals, you ought to find all those missing links. And so you can imagine the excitement in 1874 when they discovered a species of animal that looked a bit like bird and looked a bit like reptile. It was called Archaeopteryx. Well, that was a massively exciting discovery for the scientific world. And in the very same year, a German biologist named Ernst Haeckel produced a series of drawings that seemed to show that human embryos passed through all of Charles Darwin's evolutionary stages. They went from fish to reptile to bird to mammal. And we thought, wow, it's all there. Darwin was right. But the big turning point came with the discovery of genetics. Now, how are you going? I'm going to keep checking on you. Because I know what it's like to teach science, because I've done a bit of that. In Darwin's time, little was known about cells. You know the cells in your body? Very little was known about cells in Darwin's time. We just thought they were an amorphous blob of goop. Well, I didn't, because I actually didn't live then. I promise you, I wasn't back that far. But when the electron microscope was invented, it showed, no, there was actually stuff inside the cell. There was a nucleus inside the cell. And then when we looked at the nucleus, we discovered there was stuff inside of that. We discovered chromosomes. We found out they were a string of genes and that there was the missing piece. Maybe that's how Darwin's kind of species changed over time. Maybe those genes mutate. They become different. And suddenly we thought, we'd unraveled the entire mystery of life. It seemed so obvious. And all the evidence had begun to accumulate. Then in 1952, it became certainty. I wonder if you've ever heard about this experiment. It was kind of a university lab in Berkeley in America where scientists managed to put together a bunch of chemicals which they thought were just right, just in the right kind of mix. They passed a current of electricity through them. And shazam, they invented, well, they created amino acids, which are kind of the building blocks of life. And we concluded that's how it happened. Life began in a shallow pool in the ancient world billions of years ago when a bolt of lightning hit this pool of chemicals that were just right. There is no God. We've debunked that whole myth. Evolution did it all. and the evidence seemed so tremendously obvious. The excitement was immense. Now, here's the thing about science. I've kind of worked in the scientific world for quite a while, and the thing about science is it's like fashion. You know how fashions have come and gone? Any of you wearing platform shoes today? Anyone wearing their jeans this morning, like their flares? All those fashions kind of come and go, and science is a little bit like that. Evidence for a theory accumulates, the theory is strengthened. Supporting evidence comes in. University departments adopt it. Research grants are offered. A paradigm of belief forms. Reputations are made as people write research papers. Then suddenly, other evidence comes from some other research department. There are two sides now of the debate. The two sides argue. Reputation's at stake. My research paper's at stake. Actually, the theory gets modified. Sometimes the evidence is just, you can't overturn it. More counter-evidence comes in. More modifications are made. Till a point comes sometimes when you've just got to throw the theory apart altogether. You know where we thought microorganisms came from once upon a time? Spontaneous generation. We thought they just appeared out of thin air. They just invented themselves. Till we found out that Louis Pasteur proved that there were microorganisms. That theory was chucked away. Centuries ago, you know what we thought about the Earth? It was the centre of the entire universe. Not just the solar system, the universe. It was a powerful worldview. It had been around since the days of Aristotle. He was 300 and something BC. That view lasted for about 1900 years until people like Galileo saw, oh, this is not adding up. Scientists like Kepler and Copernicus said, the Earth doesn't move in perfectly round orbits and other planets don't do that. And eventually we had to let that theory go. Here's the problem for our current theory of evolution is that the more we know, and here's the crunch point, the more it becomes apparent that life's actually much more complex than we'd ever realised before. Much more complex than Charles Darwin had thought. In 1859, he knew we lacked the evidence for those, remember those transitional fossils? He knew we didn't have it. And he said as much. He was thoroughly honest about it. He made the statement, geology assuredly doesn't reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this perhaps is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. The explanation lies, as I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. Hear what he's saying? He was hoping in time we'd solve the problem of all those fossils that were missing, all those missing links. The truth is we haven't. We've got a few little ones, but we haven't got the big ones that Darwin fully expected to find. And then what we found was that Haeckel's embryo drawings, remember those drawings about the embryos that seemed to go through those stages? Well, then what we found is that he'd actually falsified the diagrams. They didn't show what he'd hoped they would show. And then we found that famous experiment to create life in the university lab that took place in Berkeley, California, got the mix of chemicals wrong. The chemicals they thought existed in the early Earth then, we now know are absolutely not the chemicals that existed in the early Earth. In fact, we got no idea. We know what those chemicals were, we just don't know how to make life out of them. So we're right back to square one with the origin of life. Then we found that the tree of life that Darwin had envisaged, that was actually in every biology book back in the 1990s and 80s, it's actually not like that at all. It's more like, if anything, a series of bushes here, there, spread across the spectrum, so that nice picture that you had of human beings evolving from monkeys through apes up to the whole thing, now that's actually all back in the melting pot. We know there's monkeys, we know there's apes, we know there might be something between. There's no link we can find persuasively between those creatures and human beings. But there were bigger problems. The bigger problems came when we discovered more about the incredible complexity of cells and genes and how they work. And you know when that happened? Over the last 30 years. It's been happening all around us over the last 30 years. Once upon a time, we thought it would be simple for mutations to produce new species of life. You know, a gene gets mutated, you get a new creature forming. Now we understand the devastating impact of many mutations. There's only so many genes in the human body. They code for all kinds of things. I've got a very dear friend who's got a son or daughter born with a rare syndrome, Angelman syndrome. It's one genetic abnormality. It affects all kinds of systems in her body, as those sorts of things always do. Think of the person with Down syndrome. So the big question then was, if you're going to get fish that form into reptiles, how do you get gills that form into functional lungs just with a mutation of a gene? You're more likely to get gills that don't work than you are to get lungs. In any case, what you're going to require is some incredible biological miracle to get from that to that. Now, scientists know that. That's not a mistake for them. But here's the biggest problem. It's even more recent. Because in the 1970s, we've slowly begun to unravel the structure of DNA. You know, the stuff that's in your cells in your body, the stuff that your chromosomes are made out of, how it codes for every protein, every component in your body. We've learned how many proteins there are. There's kind of an enormous number of them. How many of those DNA subunits, they're called nucleotides. Now you've got the one, feel free to forget it. How many of those need to be put together end to end to make DNA? You know how many it is? About 3.5 billion of them. They've got to fit together. They've got to be assembled by intricate little cellular machines that Darwin didn't know anything about. And they've got to be incredibly designed to then be put together in the right order so they'll fold. Because it actually doesn't matter if you've got the chain. If it doesn't fold properly, it's not going to work. And all that just to get life started. That's not the biggest problem. There's a bigger problem. We've realised with a shock that the chance of trial and error causing that to happen with no intelligent direction is effectively impossible. It's mathematically a zero chance. And especially given that if it did happen by some incomprehensible fluke over billions of years, and you get this chain of DNA that's formed, well, it's a little bit like this. It's a little bit like discovering a DVD, you know, when you lived in the 18th century. And then you've got to get that thing to play. But no one's invented a DVD player yet. Do you see the problem? It is scientifically an insurmountable problem. But then there's a bigger problem, because after all that, imagine you get this strand of DNA that has just formed by a sheer 1 in a billion fluke. You got this one precious strand of DNA, and that sucker needs to learn how to make more of itself before it disappears into the primordial slime forever. How do you get that thing to self-replicate? That's the term. How do you get it to reproduce more of itself? Now, frankly, it's a complete mystery. No one in the scientific world has an answer to that. No one has a clue how to solve it. And even if we allow 4.5 billion years for the age of the Earth, which is what scientists suspect it is, that's not nearly enough time for evolution on its own to do it. This is not just a gap, you see, in our scientific knowledge, that if we discover more, as a fellow was saying to me over the barbecue last night, he's saying, isn't it something we just, in time, science will find the answers to that? No, it's not just a gap. It's an issue of intelligence, because if you've got a coded language, you need intelligence to decode it. theoretically, it's possible if you have an infinite amount of time, but the fact of the matter is, we don't have an infinite amount of time in our universe. In fact, here's the ironic twist. The great hope for evolutionists who deny the idea of a intelligent designer in life, you know where they're looking for, you know where they're looking at the moment for that intelligent life to appear from?
Other universe.
Other universe, outer space, yeah. It's SETI, it's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Because we're thinking, well, man, 4.5 billion years on the Earth, that's not enough time. But if you give it another 9 billion years out in space, maybe then, not even nearly. Not even nearly. Now, why opt for that conclusion rather than a creator God? Well, that's the key question, friends. And here's the clue to the answer. Listen to this comment by a man named Richard Lewontin. He's a famous Harvard geneticist. He says, and I'll read you the full quote, "Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to a real understanding of the struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs," not all, friends, some of its constructs, "in spite of the tolerance of some in the scientific community for just so stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism." Got that term? It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation for the phenomenal world. On the contrary, we're forced by our a priori commitment to material causes. And then he goes on to say at the end there, which I've not put up for you, "Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Hear what he's saying? Now, he's being perfectly honest. That's why he's happy to go and print for it. Because the materialist is saying, we will accept only material causes. And so if something else comes out of somewhere else, we're not listening. We're interested in this, material causes. And therefore, all sorts of evidence that comes up that's contrary is simply not seen. Friends, there is a battle. There is a battle. But it's not between God and science. It's between those committed to a materialistic worldview and those who find in the universe evidence for a creative intelligence that makes all this stuff possible. Someone put it like this. Imagine you're a native from deepest, darkest Africa who's never seen a car before, as if someone like that exists anymore. And you hear that Henry Ford created the first motor car. And you might think Henry Ford was some kind of god who lives inside it. But you take the thing apart, you put it back together again, you learn the workings of the internal combustion engine, and you don't find Henry in there. There's no Henry to find. Does that mean you've disproved Henry Ford's existence? No. The designer exists at a whole other level. And there's the very point with God. Not like you're going to find him inside the machinery. Actually, it's his design that makes our scientific discoveries possible. Because he's orderly, logical, he's structured. Now, what does all this mean? Let me give you a couple of things and stop. It means a whole bunch of things. A whole bunch of things. Firstly, we human beings, we are terribly prone to bias. And we need to be aware of that. There can be bias in our interpretations of the Bible. Our interpretations are not inspired by God. The Bible itself is. Our interpretations aren't. And they can be biased too in scientific claims. It's possible to make assumptions which aren't well-founded, to simply ignore evidence because it weakens our case. And our reputations are at stake and our faculty grants are at stake. And in the last 60 years, lots of evidence has arisen that dramatically weakens the full evolutionary case. Not all of it. That doesn't mean throw the whole thing away. But it does require some honesty. To pick up a question that was asked during the week, that at the popular level on TV and in classroom biology textbooks is taking a very, very long time to acknowledge. Because that's how science works. It takes a very, very long time. Here's the second thing, and I'm going to stop. Secondly, wise Christians should never be anti-science. Don't be anti-science. When the true facts are properly understood, there's no need to be scared. We want to welcome scientific discovery. We want to listen to it and be well informed about it. And there's no need for conflict so long as you've got good science and you've got clear-minded Christianity. It's a great adventure. Now, I've got a couple of other things to say, but let me stop there and see if you want to ask questions. And if we need to run the mic, Cal, can we do that? But if you've got a loud voice, just ask it from the floor. Shay's got it there. Yeah, do you want to ask questions? Or have I completely bamboozled you with science? Yeah, Carrie.
I always have a question, Craig.
You do? Yes.
I do. So just on this last note of materialism, why is God considered not materialist and aliens, the potential of aliens or SETI, whatever you call it, extraterrestrial
yes.
intelligence,
yep.
why is that considered not considered immaterial as well, if that makes sense?
Well, let me answer both parts of that. God is non-material, of course, by even any Christian definition. But SETI is not hoping that there's aliens necessarily who've created that life. They're hoping that life's arisen by evolutionary means somewhere out in space somewhere else. Yeah. The very odd thing about that, of course, is if any microorganism that grew out in space could survive the extreme cold of temperatures out in space and the extreme heat of temperatures required for like an asteroid or a meteorite to land on Earth's surface, if there's organisms that are like that, then what do you imagine would happen once they get to Earth? They'll be everywhere. They can survive anywhere, those things. They can survive blinding heat. They can survive incredible cold. They ought to be everywhere. But we haven't found those. So they're not looking for a material explanation out in space. Yep. Yeah, great question though. Yeah. Got others? Oh, yep, Greg, yeah. Don't let me off too easily. Make sure you ask all the hard questions.
Hey, Craig. Look, my understanding is that the Bible teaches that with sin came death. And I wonder how that plays out, that if animals were living and dying and
yep.
people were evolving, or if not people, other things were evolving, then there was death long before the biblical account of sin. How
yes.
does that work?
Yeah, well, given the fact we're recording this and I'll have to go on record here and suggest, I think that's a very big and important issue. And my tentative suggestion would be, actually, let me just go back and draw out a logical point for you for a moment. Creatures existed on Earth before human beings. Genesis is not saying anything contrary to that. Dinosaurs existed on Earth prior to human beings. Are we saying no dinosaurs actually accidentally trod on an ant somewhere along the line? Or, you know, inhaled a fly or like you do sometimes? Are we saying that never occurred? I don't think that's the Bible's point. I think the Bible's point is that death as it affects human life entered with Adam. That'd be my suggestion to that dilemma. I don't think it's saying there was no death whatsoever. But I realise that's a very controversial position for some, and I advance that point very tentatively. But I think it's plausible. Yeah. Got others? Yeah, Izzy. Now, I realise, guys, this is longer than we go this morning, although we're only at 1:45 now, but I want you to have every opportunity to ask the stuff on this. So.
Oh, I was just wondering about Neanderthals and stuff like that, like the before people, because they have like ideas of like skulls and stuff they found in archaeological digs, and I'm just wondering like how does that work with like, I don't know, macroevolution and what you've been saying about it.
Yeah, thanks for raising that. Izzy's raised an issue, macroevolution and microevolution, and paleontology, which is a study that of fossils, in particular human kind of remains, but human paleontology is kind of a very, very tricky science. In fact, some scientists would say it's like the dark arts of the scientific world, because you find a femur of a living organism which you think to be humanoid or some sort of primate, or you find a little piece of calvarium skull. Right, you find a little bit of that, and out of that you've got to construct frequently the entire skeleton, what it was like. Did it walk on four legs? Was it human or not? And so lots of that actually is I think it's fair to say, not doing a disservice to that particular scientific discipline, it's a little bit of shuffling and trying to work out what's the most logical thing. Very difficult to be precise on paleontology. Now, I'm not an expert on paleontology, and I'd certainly welcome anyone out there in cyberland to reply on that, but we don't have the smooth curve from apes to human beings. We actually don't have anything that links the two. Where we put some of those skeletons is actually up for grabs. Got others? Yeah, Lucas.
Just sort of by extension of Izzy's question. There's sort of a common ancestor in the Middle East and a common ancestor in Africa. So how would science and also the Bible explain why humans are so many different sizes, so many different colours, so many different characteristics?
Yeah, you raised a question. There's a common ancestor here, there's a common ancestor there. There are things that we think may be common ancestors, to go back to Izzy's point there. But to raise your question about why is there so much human variation, that's an easy one to answer, actually. That's simple genetics. You can tell, can't you? I've got the genes for very tall people in my family. My parents were very tall, my wife's tall, so our kids are gigantic. Not, right? But somewhere in our genetic makeup, there will be that sort of gene. And when that's expressed, according to simple genetics, you will get human variation. You'll get genes that are dominant, and so you get change of skin colour. They're fairly simple things to work out. Not necessarily even simple mutation, simple selection. So one of the things we know about genes now is much of that genetic... You've heard about junk DNA? Yeah? We thought that 97% of your DNA was just junk until how long ago? About 4 years? 4 years ago. We found out it's not junk DNA. Lots of your DNA actually activates other genes and causes them to be expressed. And that's why you get all sorts of variations in human beings. See how recently, see how quickly this stuff is moving? So lots of our scientific evidence is just naive and old. Now, that's not saying I'm cutting edge and I'm up to date. I'm fairly up to date, I think. Got any more? Let me finish. Feel free to ask it over morning tea. Let me draw your attention to the question we began with. Why does this matter? Why does it matter? You might be joining us this morning because you were interested in this topic. It matters because the worldview of materialism, which has shaped the assumptions of many modern scientists, can only envisage a world based on material assumptions. It's purposeless, it's meaningless, it's hopeless in the sense that there is no great hope for the future. It's morally confused because there's no objective basis for right and wrong. And most of us, I say quietly, most of us don't buy that. Most of us don't live our lives that way. And we're right not to buy it, because that view is harmful, destructive, and the evidence for it is actually far more tenuous than most of our biology classroom teachers realise. Because you know who the last person to know in the world is? It's the poor classroom teacher who's at the bottom end of the intellectual chain trying to make that information available to school kids who actually are at the very bottom of that chain. The information we have for a world that's very much more complex than the evolutionary one is rich, very rich. And not to say that evolution's all wrong, it's just to say there's something else there. And more importantly, this says that there is a creator God. There is, to say, a creative intelligence that is at work in our community, in the world in which we live, that who bears all the marks of the God that Jesus spoke about. I put this slide up for you so you can see that what Richard Dawkins acknowledges quietly on these things. He says it's grindingly, creakingly, crashingly obvious that if Darwinism were really just a theory of chance, it couldn't work. You don't need to be a mathematician or a physicist to calculate that an eye or a hemoglobin molecule would take from here to infinity to assemble itself by sheer higgledy-piggledy luck. Now, what's he saying there? He's saying there's something bigger going on in Darwinism than he's letting on, but he's holding out for a material answer, not an intelligent answer. And the evidence actually suggests there's an intelligence required of exactly the kind that Jesus spoke about. And if that's the case, friends, it means this. You live in his world. You inhabit the world that he's made. He's designed us for himself. He's designed the world to be beautiful and glorious, and it matters that we come to terms with him. And Jesus is the place to start. In fact, as people who want to live by the truth, I want to urge you, this merits your careful investigation, demands your careful investigation. And I'd say, come to life. Sign up down the back table this morning. Come to life. Start the inquiry. It will be worth your doing. We're going to sing. You can catch me over morning tea. Let me pray, and the band will lead us. Our Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for truth, for all truth, scientific truth, and every other branch of inquiry. We want to pray, Father, that we will be people of the truth, not shutting it down, but opening our eyes to it, but confident too that you're one who loves and cares and is keen for us to know, but keen for us to be brought to yourself. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.